Hello and welcome. I am your host, Randy Andrews, and today I've got Joe Patrick from the Two-Headed Nerd comic podcast on my show with me today. We will be discussing Superman from 1978, how it has changed through the years, the effect in comics, as well as the wonderful scoring by John Williams, today on Soundtrack Alley. Hello, Joe. It's great to have you finally on my show.
Randy, it is great to be here.
So today we're talking about Superman. And from past experiences, I have learned that this is one of your favorite movies of all time.
Oh, yeah. Superman is probably my favorite movie, period.
Awesome.
Like my number one.
That's fantastic. So when you first saw Superman, what kind of feelings did you have toward it?
Oh, gosh. You know, I would have been so little. So Superman, the movie, came out the year I was born. And so I was like the first time I saw it, you know, I could have been a baby. But by the time I was old enough to kind of understand what was happening, like I've been a comic book fan my whole life, so I knew what Superman was, and just to see that character on the screen doing the things that he can do, just kind of like come to life. That would have been the first time anything like that had happened, to in my experience. Mm-hmm. Even though, of course, there had been, you know, there was the Batman show in the 60s and stuff, but for me, Superman was the first. And, yeah, gosh, it's stuck with me ever since. I never get tired of it.
That's just awesome. You know, when you look at Christopher Reeves on screen and see him be Superman, you know, it's really amazing that, you know, he underwent like a lot of bodybuilding. And you know, what was unique about that was that he was supervised by David Prowse.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. So
Darth Vader?
Yeah, he was supervised by Darth Vader and to do that. And I found it really unique for that moment. It's like, wow, you're being taught bodybuilding by an icon.
That's hilarious. I did not know that.
Yeah. So, you know, when we look at Superman and the idea of Superman, how do you think it changes through the years? Like with the 1978 Superman, it was the first Superman people had seen on the big screen. And do you think that a lot of changes were made according to the film, or what have you found?
You know, I have said in the past, and I'm sticking with it, that I think that Superman the movie, for the time, for where the comics were at the time, Superman the movie is probably one of the most faithful comic book to screen adaptations ever.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of the iconic characters are there, the themes are there. You know, there might be little detail changes here and there, but it's like that with every time they translate something to TV or film. But with Superman, it is just really, really close to the style and the feel of the Superman comics of the day. Like from the costuming on down. Like, of course, Lex Luthor was a little different. Gene Hackman with his full head of hair that, of course, we find out at the end is fake. You know, comic book Lex Luthor was bald and proud.
Yeah.
So he wasn't like trying to hide it.
I found it interesting with Gene Hackman. He originally didn't want to shave his mustache off for the role. He wanted to keep his mustache on. And so early one sheets of the movie, his face featured a mustache. But then, and that was before Richard Donner had talked with him and met him face to face. And so Donner would cut his mustache off. So Gene Hackman agreed to do it as well. And so then,
oh my gosh,
he wore a false mustache at some point to where he would peel it off at the last moment just to give him a joke.
That's funny. Yeah. I didn't know that either.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just interesting. These characters, these actors that were in the film, it's like they had their little quirks to be able to use for the film itself. What did you think of Marlon?
Right.
What did you think of Marlon Brando?
You know, at the time, Marlon Brando was probably the most famous actor in that movie. You know, of course, Gene Hackman and Christopher Reeve and these guys, they're like legendary figures now. But in 1978, Marlon Brando was like a huge star. And it was only a handful of years after The Godfather. And in fact, one of the funniest trivia things about Superman is that the guy that wrote the Superman screenplay is the guy that wrote The Godfather.
Oh, really?
Mario Puzo. He wrote the novel, The Godfather, that the Godfather movie was based on, and he also wrote the Superman screenplay. So he had that kind of tie there.
Yeah, so it was perfect for his role.
Yeah. I think that he was really great. There are a lot of rumors from that time about how, like, Marlon Brando just kind of showed up one afternoon and did his whole part in like one day and got paid a huge amount of money. Like, it was no big deal. I'm Marlon Brando. Yeah. Get out of my way. I'm a gigantic star.
Well, part of that's true.
But yeah, but I think that he did a great job as Jor-El in the movie. I think that later on in the film where young Clark Kent kind of meets him for the first time via those holograms, I just think it's very powerful, and I think he does a great job.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that he refused to memorize all his lines. And, I mean, that's pretty, you know, normal, I would think, for a lot of actors to be able to just, you know, try to fit it into where they could and not have to remember every single line. And
yeah,
one of the scenes where he was putting the infant Kal-El into the escape pod, he was actually reading his lines from the diaper of the baby.
Oh my gosh.
So,
well, I mean, he pulled it off.
Yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't have even known that he was reading his lines. So I found it unique that Steven Spielberg was even offered the chance to direct the film. But the producers didn't like the salary that he wanted to go with. So,
oh boy. Yeah.
So they decided to look back on his film with Jaws, and, Steven Spielberg, he went on to do other projects. And so they had Richard Donner do the film. So,
yeah, I think things ended up okay for Steven Spielberg.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, just a few weeks ago I had, Eric Woods from Cinematic Sound Radio on my show, and we talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark. And, you know, Steven Spielberg had no problem with getting work.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So, with Christopher Reeve, I mean, the last film that he may have even been wasn't somewhere in time after Superman.
I think so.
Yeah, I
think so.
I thought so too, because I hadn't heard of him doing another film before that. And so, you know, he was pretty much an unknown for the movie. But I think they chose the right man for the job.
I agree. I think that he really embodies not only, like, he's not the bulkiest guy, you know. Mm-hmm. He worked out and got fit for the part and everything, but you know, he's not like a huge superhero looking fella. But I think he embodies the spirit of Superman, you know, the kind of noble, the noble figure that stands up for what's right. You know, the sort of guy that when you see him, you know that everything's going to be okay. But yeah, I think he's wonderful. All I really knew him for was Superman. I know that he did other things, but, every time I ever saw him in something different, it felt so weird to me.
Oh yeah.
I was like, what's Superman doing in this movie?
Yeah, because like when you see him in Somewhere in Time, for instance, he plays a totally different character, and he's not even, you know, he's not like standing around as, oh, I'm Superman. So.
Right. Yeah, that came out 2 years later. You're mm-hmm. right.
So, I mean, that just was something unique. When, you know, when Christopher Reeve portrayed Clark Kent, you know, as his alter ego, I found it interesting that he based his performance for Clark Kent upon Cary Grant's character in Bringing Up Baby.
Really?
Yeah. I never knew that before, and I was like, yeah, I could see that. I could totally see that.
Well, yeah, I mean, actors are known for getting their inspiration from all sorts of sources, but yeah, I think that he just nails that characterization, that switch, that ability to flip the switch between Superman and Clark Kent, mm-hmm. you know, just at a second's notice.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite parts about him.
Yeah, he was, you know, he was really brilliant for the role that he was given. And I found it good that even before being cast as Superman, he knew how to fly gliders as a hobby. And his experience as a pilot even made it better for him to know how Superman's flying would feel more realistic.
Oh, yeah, he was an old pro then.
So I found that...
That's great.
Yeah. So what do you think about Margaret Kidder being portrayed as Lois Lane?
You know, I think Margot Kidder is decent as Lois Lane. There have been lots of versions of Lois Lane over the years, but I don't think anybody has really nailed the kind of like ambitious reporter willing to put herself in danger mm-hmm. As well as Margot Kidder did. And that was a hallmark of Lois Lane, the comic book character. But yeah, I think that she's wonderful as Lois Lane in the first several Superman movies. You know, the Superman movies, like anything with a bunch of sequels, it kind of goes downhill over time. Yeah. But those first two Superman movies are just spectacular. And I think that everybody in the cast just really nails the parts.
Oh, yeah.
But I like Margot Kidder a lot as Lois Lane.
Yeah, she embodies the role really well because she was a go-get-em reporter. She wasn't really concerned about her looks. She was more concerned about the story, and you get that even from the comics, that she's not really concerned about her looks. She's more concerned about, all right, where's the next story coming from? How am I going to get paid?
Well, yeah, she's focused, like you said, on telling that next story, on getting to the truth of things, you know, on revealing secrets that need to be told. And it doesn't matter to her whether or not she's got to get her hands a little dirty or whether it's a dangerous situation. Lois Lane has to get that story, and the character, they really nailed that in the character, in this version of the character. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought so too. I've always found, like, when I watched it, I had rented it from the library, and the version that I watched was the extended cut. And so it mm-hmm. had, you know, it had some extended scenes of her and Superman flying across the city and everything. And then the semi song that she was singing, even though she was just wording it, she right. was supposed to actually sing it.
Can you read my mind?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Probably my least favorite part of the movie, but you know,
it furthered the story in a way of their relationship. Yeah. So that right. was good.
It's just pretty cheesy, but like, yeah, you're right. It does kind of show them embracing that connection between the two characters.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the reason why we're here is to talk about the score. And I mean, John Williams just blew it away with his themes and his sweeping melodies and even the love theme that was chosen for Lois and Superman.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest reasons that I love Superman the movie so much is because of the music. Mm-hmm. And I have said this before. I've said it on my show. I've told other people. But all I have to do is hear, you know, the opening bars of that main theme
mm-hmm.
before I start to get kind of emotional.
It's almost a giddy because, feeling.
Yeah, because, like, it means so much to me. And, you know, like, I can, like, I started last week, you know, we had originally planned to have this conversation last mm-hmm. week. And so I listened to the soundtrack at work, and as I'm listening to the soundtrack, I was replaying the movie in my mind, mm-hmm. You know, just like note for note. And I think that other than maybe like Star Wars or the Indiana Jones movies, you know, no coincidence by the same composer. Mm-hmm. For me, there's no other movie that is so iconically tied to its score as this one. And I love it from start to finish, especially that main theme.
Yeah, it's like in the extended cut, you get like the little intro of the 50s television and the black and white movie type
thing. Oh, right.
And then, yeah. And then it builds and you hear that. Bum, bum, bum.
Oh, that's it, Randy. That's where I start to get the goosebumps right there.
So, you know, John Williams made that theme so simple and yet so effective. He did that, I mean, between his time between 1975 and 1984, he was at the top of his game of being able yeah. to build these characters, to build these scores, and to show that these characters had each a theme that would transition and carry you through the story.
Right. I mean, and yeah, like every movie, almost every movie that he scored during that time is an iconic part of somebody's childhood. Like starting with the Jaws theme, you know, mm-hmm. Who doesn't hear that like deep cello sound and immediately think that there's a shark nearby? Yeah. You know, and it's not just the main theme, you know, it's just like whenever I think of Lex Luthor or his henchmen in my head, I'm going bump. It's the Otis theme,
yep.
And yeah, it's like it's so ingrained in my memory, and yeah, John Williams, like you said, I don't think there's anybody better for for this sort of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, originally Richard Donner was going to get Jerry Goldsmith to do the score.
Oh my God, I can't imagine.
I know, and he had agreed to do it, but because of scheduling conflicts, John Williams was eagerly replacing Goldsmith. And so,
thank God.
So Goldsmith, however, he was going to do music for Supergirl.
Sure.
So, you know, it changed. I mean, he was still able to write a score for a super. So,
that's all right.
Yeah.
I'm glad he got involved, but I'm glad that this is my Superman music.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when you think of like different scenes in the movie and like even looking at the planet Krypton, did you envision it as it was in the movie from the comics, or was there a good transition there, or do you think there was a big difference?
You know, in the movie, Krypton is a lot different than it was in the comics. At the time, because when the idea of Krypton was introduced back in the late 30s, early 40s, it was sort of this like pulp sci-fi, you know, like Buck Rogers style, you know, guys in capes flying little rockets with ray guns. Like Krypton was a like big mega cities, super science, weird outfits.
Yeah.
And so the idea of this Krypton, the kind of cold and clinical Krypton, you know, still obviously very advanced scientifically, but this was kind of the first time they introduced the idea of Krypton as this truly alien kind of cold place. And that idea did sort of work its way into the comics eventually, mm-hmm. When they, you know, they rebooted things in the 80s. And you had a version of Krypton much more similar to this than the classic version. But I still think it works. Like you see all those scenes, you know, you've got that trial scene at the beginning.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, you don't even realize what they're setting up at the time. They're setting up Superman 2 already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and everybody's in these glowing robes, you know, with these symbols on their shirts.
Yeah.
It's just, you know that there's a story there. You know that there is some sort of interesting cultural reason for all of that, but they don't really get into it. They just kind of let you... come to your own conclusions, which I think is kind of neat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really shows the depth of thought maybe that they even went into bringing out the world of Krypton. And you look at the costuming that to obtain that glowing effect, they actually had the wardrobe department spend weeks sewing these tiny glass balls onto each of the actor's apparel. And so if the material was accidentally touched, the oils on the actor's hands would interfere with that lighting effect. And so,
oh man,
they had to make sure that they weren't touching those tiny glass balls as
like a surgeon that had just scrubbed in for surgery.
Yeah.
Keep your hands off.
They were in a clean room. So,
oh man,
but even the music of Krypton, and even as Jor-El had brought to their attention about the destruction of Krypton, the doom that really John Williams brings out in that theme is essential to the story.
Right. Yeah. There's the two tracks kind of side by side on the soundtrack. There's the planet Krypton and then Destruction of Krypton. And the planet Krypton is that kind of like sweeping orchestral, you know, sound that plays as they swoop across like the barren landscape of Krypton and kind of introduce you to what the world looks like. And it's just this very majestic, you know, even though it's this cold alien place, the music lets you know that it's this, this majestic,
culture,
impressive culture. Right. And yeah, I love the Krypton music.
Yeah. And so even, you know, even as, you know, we see that beginning opening and then you see the destruction of Krypton and, Superman gets sent off into space. You get that feeling even through the music as you have the horns going back and forth, like he's hurtling through space and learning all this knowledge. And it's just, you know, it was really astounding that, you know, John Williams was able to get these pieces of music to fit together so well.
Yeah, it's very effective. You know, the music kind of does its own form of storytelling, and it's very effective in these scenes. You know, where baby Kal-El is flying through space and learning at an advanced speed, and the music kind of like speeds up and it gets sort of like a little bit more, it's just kind of a little bit more scrambly and
chaotic.
Right. Exactly. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And as all of this input is flooding into this baby, and then you see him kind of slowly, well,
start
not slowly, but you see him growing a little bit. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, just the kind of the way that they imply the amount of time that he's traveling and the growth and the development that he's going through. It's very effective.
Oh yeah. And, you know, when we see different parts of the movie and then it can call back to even the Fortress of Solitude. And I have the expanded edition for the soundtrack. And so the scene where it's the Fortress of Solitude, it's a 9-minute cue. And
it's long.
It's a massive cue, but there's so much that Jor-El, the hologram, is telling Superman that it's important to the story, and you find this is more information that we needed because of even Jor-El's orders for Clark not to interfere with human history or the events of what was happening. And so how do we see that change by the end of the movie?
Right. And well, you know, the length of that piece, you know, when you think about he enters the Fortress of Solitude as a teenager, and when he comes out, he's Christopher Reeve in costume, mm-hmm. heading to Metropolis for the first time. So again, you've got that implied passage of time. We don't know how much time has passed. But just the idea that Jor-El is flooding him with this knowledge and teaching him how to use his powers and helping him form his sense of morality and right and wrong, and how you're not a god, you know, you can't rule these people. You can't control their destiny. Like you said, you can't alter their history. You know, I love those scenes, and like with any good composer, they're always calling back to those themes later in the movie to kind of reintroduce the idea. Like when the bomb goes off and he wants to change time to save Lois, and he has those visions of Jor-El, don't do it, you can't do it.
Yeah.
Like those callbacks, it just sticks with you.
Mm-hmm. And even, you know, I mean, of course, we found that he did went ahead and
yeah, he
and
did.
Do it.
I guess it all worked out.
Yeah, but you know, the interesting thing about it is that, you know, when they filmed that scene where he actually went out of the Earth, we find that they had settled on like a forward projection for a lot of the scenes of like when Christopher Reeve would zoom up into the sky or something. And then I read somewhere of what the actual, like, amount of times that he was supposed to go around the Earth to change the, like, redo the past. And I can't remember where I read it, but, because it's not in my notes. But it was really astounding because they actually figured it out mathematically of how many times he would need to do that.
I imagine it was a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting with a lot of, you know, when we look at the comics once again, and we think about novelizations for the comic book adaptions, because as you said, with Superman or Superman 2, they didn't really have a lot with the story that was directly tied into the comics.
Yeah, right. You know, they have these characters that are obviously from the comics, but they're not directly retelling anything specific. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you have Lex Luthor's plan to knock half of California into the sea and make $1 billion in real estate, you know, that's an original story. When you have General Zod and his cronies escape the Phantom Zone and come to Earth and discover that they have powers, that's a new thing, using existing characters. Like, General Zod existed, mm-hmm, in the comics, in the Golden Age and Silver Age Superman comics. You know, Superman had the Superman comics had this bad habit. You know, the idea was, like, he's the last one. He's the only survivor. And at a certain point, they must have gotten bored or ran out of ideas or something. And so they slowly started to introduce the idea that maybe he didn't. Maybe he wasn't the only survivor. Maybe he had a cousin. Mm-hmm. Or maybe he's got a bunch of people that live in a bottle city in his fortress.
Yeah.
And then they came up with the idea of the Phantom Zone. Mm-hmm. And in the Phantom Zone is, like, literally an army of bad guys from Krypton that are just, like, conveniently plucked out whenever they need somebody really tough for Superman to fight.
Yeah.
So,
that's a plot device, but yeah, but it works.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just kind of funny, like, the idea, like, Superman is the last son of Krypton. Well, not really. There's, like, 200 or 300 Kryptonians hanging around out there somewhere. Yeah. So they take these original ideas. They take these classic ideas, and then they put their own original spin on them. And they're doing it now still with the modern movies. Like, even when they redo an origin story, like, for something we know, mm-hmm, backwards and forwards, like Batman. Like, how many times have we seen the origin of Batman?
Probably 6 times.
Right. But they always put their own little spin on it. Doctor Strange, the Doctor Strange movie that just came out, was a great example of them taking the core of the idea and then spinning it into something original. And that's what they did here with these Superman movies.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we see the comparison between... we see the comparison between the comics and then the movies, and we see how, with the themes of even the music, we can really get into that. And then that's what I'd like to do now, is really get into playing a few cues from the movie. And
oh, great,
because I've got, like, a long opening sequence for the titles. And when we look at, you know, we've talked about the vision of the planet Krypton and the destruction of it. And with these pieces, even with the scenes in the movie, we've talked about the comparisons of what the comics originally were like and then how the movie had portrayed it. And, Do you think the score really compares really well to the images that we see on the screen?
Oh yeah. You know, I think that, you know, when you're watching Superman and you hear, say, the music during his time as a teenager, right, where he's like growing up in Smallville.
Yeah.
It still has those familiar punches from the main theme in it. But in a slightly different way, like maybe a little bit less, you know, you get a sense that it's like, oh, well, this guy is Superman, but it's not quite so majestic, right? It's not the most heroic theme. It's just kind of like a nice, like a light, youthful theme with the familiar hint that like, oh, this is this hero's story that we're hearing. You know, so I think that the music during that scene is effective because it conveys that kind of youthful time and still kind of reminds you with those familiar beats that, hey, this is Superman. You know, he's growing into the greatest hero that ever lived.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that the music is a perfect fit.
Yeah, I would have to agree. So the first three cues that I'd really like to play, but these three pieces, they blend the music seamlessly together, and I've created kind of a suite using the prelude and the title march, the planet Krypton, and then the destruction of Krypton. So we'll hear that now.
Thank you.
Okay, so Joe, next I've got the one cue named the Fortress of Solitude. Now, we've talked a little bit about that theme and how, you know, the Fortress of Solitude stands up as something that Superman can go to at any time. Do you think it?
Yeah.
Do you think it stands up in the comics as a place for Superman to go to get away from everything?
Oh yeah, they always, you know, comics are constantly getting rebooted and retooled, and the past is getting rewritten. It's just what happens when you've got characters that have been around for 80 years. But they always come back to the Fortress of Solitude. It's just a cool idea. And so they have that still in the comics. It's an alien place. Not, I mean, it's on Earth, but you know, it's a place that's otherworldly, you know, so it's an otherworldly place on this world where Superman can get away and just kind of be himself and be alone and, you know, think about things, make plans, do super science or whatever. He's got fun trophies in there. He's got like memorials to his birth parents. And so, it's always a little bit more, detailed, and decorated, let's say, mm-hmm. Than the movie version, which is just like, you are inside a cave of ice.
Yeah.
but yeah, like the Fortress of Solitude. Right, right. But the Fortress of Solitude is a classic idea, still around today.
All right. So now we'll hear the Fortress of Solitude.
Thank you.
So the final piece I'd like to play is called The Finale and the End March. Joe, I'd like to ask you, how does this piece make you feel?
I love it. I love it so much. you know, I kind of view the finale march and the opening march as kind of two halves of the same piece. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so, like, for me, nothing embodies Superman more than those pieces of music. Whenever I hear them, they are so closely tied to my idea of Superman and my memory of Superman and my love of that character, that I just think the world of them. I really, really love them.
That's good. And, you know, it gives you a feeling of, like, accomplishment that the character of Superman has done his deeds, his superpowers he's righted wrongs, and, you know, he's brought justice to people, and he stands for truth and justice, and, you know, up, up, and away.
Right. Right, exactly. It's all of these feelings, you know. It's the, like you said, the feeling that justice has been done, that something good has happened, that wrongs have been righted, but also, you know, this feeling of hope and victory and all of this, all of these, you know, positive, uplifting, empowering, ideas just kind of like swirl through my mind whenever I hear this music.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is I'd really like to thank you for being on the show tonight. It's been really enjoyable to be able to talk about your favorite movie, and it's got to be probably your favorite movie of all time.
Yes, sir.
And even being able to talk about the score and how much it means even to both of us, because we kind of grew up at the same time. So, you know, we look at this movie as something iconic from our past and really can feel that the music and even the movie embodies what Superman really should be, unlike the modern retelling of Superman.
Oh, you're so right, Randy. You're so right. And it's been my pleasure. I'm so glad you asked me to come on.
Yeah, and so I hope that sometime in the future I can have you on the show again. I know you're getting the Two-Headed Nerd comic podcast up and running again with Matt Baum. And
yes, we're coming back. Actually, we're launching. Our big relaunch is being recorded this weekend. So
awesome.
We'll be back on iTunes before you know it.
All right. So where can people find you at this moment?
So our website is twoheadednerd.com. That's where you can find all the things we post on our site, all of our past episodes, which you can still download. Just have to download them directly from mm-hmm. us. We're on Facebook. If you just search for Two Headed Nerd, you'll find us. We're on Twitter at Two Headed Nerd. Me personally, my Twitter account is at JoePatrick116. So we're all over the place, man.
That's fantastic. And you can find me at SoundtrackAlley.net. I've actually revamped my website, so that way I've got a new logo. You'll have to check it out. It's pretty amazing.
Congrats.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And it's a big thank you and shout out to the Podcast Arcade Network. I have now been officially brought in to that network. So,
hey, that's great news.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm really excited about it, and it means a lot of exciting times ahead. And, I've already had like multiple, messages from people that want to be on my show now. So it's kind of fun.
That's great.
Yeah. So
that's great.
So that's it for today. You can find my show on soundtrackalley.podbean.com, or you can follow it on iTunes, and any review or rating that you give my show helps me get noticed more, and it's always a pleasure. So that's all for today, and so ending this episode, I'll play the finale and the end march. So happy listening. Thank you. thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley, the podcast. I hope you take some time to review my podcast on iTunes and also listen to it on Podbean. And if you leave a review or rating on there, it'll help us get noticed on iTunes. Thank you so much. Have a good day. Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley Spotlight. If you are on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Also, if you want to leave a comment, question, or concern, please email me at soundtrackalley@gmail.com and enjoy looking at my blog at soundtrackalley.com.